So I swear I'm going to stop talking about how bad Sunnyvale sucks and how my life isn't great right now. But this podcast is kind of keeping me going as far as like it's giving me a project. It's giving me something to focus on. And I think we all kind of need that in some way, whatever it is, that thing that, you know, kind of keeps us excited and whatnot. So this episode, let's see, we'll talk about some book stuff, some movies, some funny shit, some restaurants, and some other crap.
You are my density. You are my density.
And first off, I actually sent a new Cameo request to Eric Roberts, and I sent him the link to the episode about him. And the guy actually responded back, said he listened to it, and he posted it on his damn Twitter account or X or whatever the hell it is. So the guy just, he restores my faith in humanity. The guy seems like the best dude on the planet. So anyway, thank you, Eric Roberts, and keep up the good work. And really quick correction, the restaurant where Robert Blake, you know, ate at a lot and supposedly, you know, that's where he shot his wife outside the parking lot or whatever the hell it was, Vitello's. It actually never closed. I think it just changed hands and they totally revamped the place. They actually ended up selling some of the furniture. And I think they like auctioned off like Robert Blake's favorite booth, which is a little tacky, but also I kind of understand the appeal. It's kind of cool. And I came across some weird movie of his. I guess he did a few TV movies where he plays this like Los Angeles detective in the, it's called Joe Dancer. They're for free on Amazon. There's like three for made for TV movies. The one I started watching last night was called Joe Dancer, The Big Black Pill from 1981. It's so corny. He's like the creator of it. And it's like, it's got this voiceover, but it's just the LA locations are amazing. And the plots are totally goofy. But if you just want something so 80s and so LA, that totally fits the bill. And also in the music episode, I said I played soccer with Blonde Redhead. Well, I actually played soccer with the lead singer and the drummer, Amadeo and Simone. The other guitarist and singer, Kazu, she wasn't there. So that's really a non-important detail, but I just wanted to clarify it was me and the two twins. And weirdly enough, I had just mentioned the Irish Rover, the bar in Los Angeles, on the last episode. And a perennial staple on the jukebox there was the Pogues, Shane McGowan's band. And they were always on, and it was just, you know, Irish to the core. You know, he was pretty troubled, but, you know, kind of a lovable guy, but just totally had problems. And him and Sinead O'Connor did a duet, and they kind of were off and on friends. And she actually named her son after Shane McGowan. And unfortunately, her son ended up committing suicide, as did Sinead O'Connor. And anyway, I read this amazing story about how Shane McGowan once, like, I don't know, while they were recording, he ate like 100 tabs of acid, and then he ate a Beach Boys record. And he just started bleeding from the mouth, which is so insane and so amazing. And I hope it's true. And it's weird when people die. It's like a lot of times the impact doesn't hit you until much later. It's like my dad died 13 years ago. And I think as a defense mechanism, I've kind of put it back in the back of my head. And like only recently have I really like, has it hit me like how much I miss him. So, yeah, so anyway, rest in peace, Shane McGowan. And I will always remember the song Summer in Siam playing at the Irish Rover, which is, you know, a beautiful little song. You know, his voice is very distinct, but anyway, it's just a great song. When it's summer in Siam and the moon is full of rainbows, when it's summer in Siam and we go through many changes, when it's summer in Siam and all I really know is that I truly am in the summer in Siam, in the summer in Siam, in the summer in Siam. And speaking of dumb things, when I was in junior high, I actually had some sweet tarts and I crushed one up and snorted it and then immediately got a bloody nose and had to go to the nurse. And the reason I think a bloody nose is right now is because I had some procedure like a week ago, some new Clarifix procedure for runny noses. And supposedly there was like, you know, not many side effects. And like 5 days afterwards, my nose just started gushing blood for a couple of days. I had to go to the ED, and then they told me to leave, and then I started bleeding again. I'm walking around the parking lot with, like, just sticking stuff up my nose and blood all over my hands and face. I mean, I look like something from The Walking Dead. And it was a miserable experience. But it did flash me back to kind of a crap movie from 1981. It's called Modern Problems. It was directed by Ken Shapiro with Chevy Chase and Dabney Coleman. I always found Chevy Chase to be super unfunny. Like, if someone is, like, a really big fan of Fletch, I usually will, like, end my friendship with them right away. But in this movie, I think he's an air traffic controller, and he gets the power of, like, telekinesis. And there's this famous scene where he makes some guy in a restaurant get this bloody nose, just this out-of-control spurting bloody nose. But yeah, other than that, I mean, the movie is not very good. And speaking of another SNL actor, I've just never really thought Bill Murray was that funny. I mean, I know that is sacrilegious to say almost. You almost cannot say that. But what can I do? It's how I feel. And on one of my other episodes, I'd mentioned the movie The Ice Harvest, Harold Ramis's kind of noir from 2005. I think I mentioned it wasn't very good. I watched it again. I watched it last night. And I was so wrong. I mean, it's so entertaining. Billy Bob Thornton is hilarious. There's some amazing scenes with, it's with John Cusack. And there's some great scenes with the character actor, Mike Starr, who's stuck in, like, a, you know, a big, huge, like, luggage cart thing. And, yeah, it's totally worth watching. It's got comedy. Oliver Platt is hilarious in it. So, yeah, it's a fun movie. Totally worth watching. And I know I have a supplement addiction, but my mom has a book addiction. She is, like, she reads a book every week or more, and her crack house is the bookstore. She could rarely go in without buying two or three books. And hell, she reads them. I mean, I buy a ton of books, and I don't usually read them. It's the weirdest thing. It's like, if it's a book or a picture book or something I really, really want, it's almost like I'll never look at it because I don't want to, like take away the experience of not looking at it, if that makes any sense. It's like, it's like, oh my God, I have it. If I look at it, then that'll be done. So it's a totally idiotic way to live. But anyway, so she loves going to bookstores, and I used to love St. Mark's bookstore in New York, but it closed. And actually, the owner recently died. But one of the great bookstores in Los Angeles is Book Soup on Sunset. They do book signings and stuff like that. They famously had, like, a Hunter S. Thompson book signing, and he was just in terrible shape. I don't know if he had done some drugs or was drinking and just was, like, vomiting and, like, on his side, just, like, signing books. I used to always see the writer Bruce Wagner there, kind of a goofy-looking dude. And at the time, he was going out with Selma Blair, who I was just in love with. But yeah, I guess she has MS, I believe, right now, but I hope she's doing okay. But one of the greatest Book Soup sightings was with Keanu Reeves. He had parked, I just pulled up, he had also parked and just pulled up next to me. He was driving, like, this Porsche, and we went in at basically the same time. And he went up to the guy in the front, and he was like, "Can you tell me where the Thomas guides are?" Which, A, this is before cell phones, I think, and this was, like, the Thomas Guide was a thing you would use to get around L.A. It was, like, you know, this massive book, and it would just go street to street, and it was the way you found out how to get to places. And so just the fact that Keanu Reeves was asking for directions to buy the book that gives you directions was, like, such a Keanu moment. And he looked great, unshaven, just looked cool, seemed cool, so... And he's supposedly a great guy, so yeah, anyway. And he has a great house in the Hollywood Hills. If you Google it and go through, like, Google Earth and go, like, through the years, like, on one of the years, you can actually see the garage door open, and he's in there, like, with his motorcycle, which is kind of cool. And then down the street from him, Leonardo DiCaprio lives. It's like a private road, and me and Buckley were stoned and driving around, and we went down there once. There was, like, a security guard at the end, and I was just like, what the hell is this? And Leonardo is looking like crap these days. He's getting older, and it's showing. And I'm also looking like crap, so I feel like I can, make that kind of comment. And right near Book Soup is the Viper Room, where I had seen Allen Ginsberg before, but also saw Hunter S. Thompson with my buddy Andy. He did, like, a talk. It was, like, moderated by Johnny Depp, and John Cusack was also there and talked a little bit. He was kind of a mess at the time. He was older. He was kind of running on fumes. It was still entertaining. You know, he always had that, like, righteous rage, and he would still, you know, he had some moments of genius every once in a while. There's an amazing phone message on YouTube where he is calling the cable company. I think they came over and like rewired his set, his TV set. And I think he had a bunch of TVs and just, you know, always had stuff, you know, the news on and stuff. And it was all fucked up now. So he just leaves this message and he's just like, you know, the fucking cables don't work anymore. I can't get the goddamn thing to turn on. You know, just come down here and I want you to fix this thing, make it the way it was. God damn it. But it is hilarious to listen to. Please look that up. And this is probably too intimate of a detail to share, but just up from the Viper Room, there was this girl that I went out with like a couple times and I just slept over. We were drunk as hell. We didn't do anything, but, you know, we just kind of cuddled and our bodies were against next to each other. And she had told a friend of mine, the one who actually set us up together, that I was pretty well hung. But this girl was admittedly extremely short. So I think it was just a perspective thing, to be honest. And the guy who wrote Permanent Midnight, Jerry Stahl, he used to write for, I think it was like either the LA Weekly or the New Times, kind of one of these free LA, you know, Los Angeles newspapers that were great. I used to email him all the time. His email was liverbad, L-I-V-E-R-B-A-D, because he had hepatitis C. And I remember I was always emailing him about like supplements and like, you know, weird treatments and alternative crap from overseas to buy and stuff. Seemed like a cool guy. I haven't read in any of his recent books, but Permanent Midnight was pretty good. Almost as a kind of a trade-off for my autograph addiction as a kid, I would sometimes email people just to get some kind of contact. I actually emailed Steve Jobs once from Apple. I think it was just steve@apple.com. He wrote back. I mean, it was a long time ago. It was like when apps were just starting. I think I had some stupid comment, like something about, I don't know, how to arrange the apps or something. He just wrote back something like, you know, good idea. And that was it. But that was kind of fun. I also emailed Alan Dershowitz after it came out that he had visited that scumbag Jeffrey Epstein and got some massages or something. But he said, I kept my underwear on. So I just, you know, emailed him and kind of called him a scum. And then another recent kind of Jeffrey Epstein email, I sent an email to Noam Chomsky, the MIT educator and, you know, huge social critic of, you know, oh, the U.S. and East Timor and all this stuff. He had actually went to dinner with Jeffrey Epstein. This was after Jeffrey Epstein was convicted as a sex offender. And I think he just said, well, it's none of your business when someone asked about it. And I think he was, talking about getting some money to MIT. But it's like, do you need the money that bad that you're dealing with this scumbag? And, you know, Noam Chomsky is, you know, so holier than thou. So, yeah, anyway, whatever. Or a better subject, I used to email Jonathan Gold, the late food critic for the LA Times. Legendary figure, just, you know, ate everywhere and just discovered restaurants and totally cool guy. I would be like, oh, my mom's visiting LA. Can you think of any places? And we would kind of go back and forth and just seemed like a great dude. And he died several years ago. There's a mural of him on Pico Boulevard. I think it says like I learned to eat on Pico or something like that. But anyway, rest in peace, Jonathan Gold. I also got a hold of Jack Dorsey. I'm not sure why. I just was like, hey, I wonder if this email gets to you. And it got to him. And then I think I tried to email again. And he had already blocked me. But, you know, hey, it's fun to try. And last little thing on books and writers. I read a funny little story. It's in a book about publishing, a new book about publishing. But the writer Bob Woodward was walking around with his agent, his literary agent. And back in the day, they used to take 10%. Now they take more than that. But anyway, they were walking around and Bob Woodward found like a dime on the floor. And so he picked it up and then kind of rummaged through his pockets and then gave his agent a penny, which I thought was, you know, pretty damn clever. I was going to mention a couple restaurant things real quick, but one movie recently about a restaurant was The Menu from 2022. I thought it was great. It was directed by Mark Mylod and had Anna Taylor-Joy and Nicholas Hoult and Ralph Fiennes, John Leguizamo. I mean, it really paid off, I thought. I mean, it's not flawless, but it just, you know, the whole ridiculous tasting menu type thing. Me and my mom have been to a couple restaurants, not obviously that fancy, but sometimes the food just gets too much. And if they're charging, you know, $200, $300 a head, it's like no food is worth that. And so, yeah, the menu kind of takes the ridiculousness to a logical extreme. And yeah, I thought it was good. It was a fairly popular movie, so probably most of you have seen it. But if not, try and check it out. And speaking of just like old school, amazing Los Angeles restaurants, there's one in Burbank called the Smokehouse. It is great. It's been there forever. It's just old, and usually like older people are in there. Me and Buckley, after we went to the graveyard up there, there's the Hollywood Hills Forest Lawn is near there, and we were stoned. And so we're like, let's go to the Smokehouse. And oh my God, it was just great. We got like a filet, and then they got a few martinis or a couple martinis. And you know, the martinis come out in a little shaker, and then they pour it, and there's more left in the shaker to like refill you. Oh, that is my favorite type of place. A lot of these like newer restaurants, they have these martini glasses that are like so small. It's like, well, this is basically half a martini. You know, if you go to like a really nice steakhouse, or I mean, Mastro's has a legendarily huge martini glass. I remember it wasn't Mastro's, but it was another New York steakhouse that I went with my mom, and it was a humongous martini. She had a martini and a glass of wine. I had a couple martinis and a glass of wine. But my mom got so drunk, it was almost like she was on acid from this martini. So it was scary for a moment, but then she came back to her senses. And another time me and Buckley were driving around, we were stoned, and we went to a gallery in downtown LA. We actually went to the wrong gallery. I was like, we were supposed to go to this one that was in like Culver City. We ended up at the one in downtown LA. But we were like, oh, let's, have you ever heard of this place, Lobster and Beer? You know, let's go eat there. So we went to this restaurant and ate there. I mean, it was okay. It was pretty good. But the funny thing is, after we left, we were driving around. I was driving around trying to get the hell out of there and go home. And I kept making a circle around the place. And we kept passing the same restaurant. And I was just like, Lobster and Beer again. And driving around, I was like, oh my God, why do we keep passing by the same thing? And he was, you know, just like, what the hell? But it was kind of reminiscent of that Chevy Chase, you know, Big Ben Parliament scene that I'd mentioned earlier. If you're ever in Sacramento, believe it or not, this place, Crew, KRU Sushi, is incredible. It's pretty damn expensive, but it's up there. It ranks up there with, you know, some of the LA places or New York places. So if you ever find yourself in Sacramento, which I hope you don't, but if you do, check that out. There's another pretty nice place in Granite Bay. It's called Hawks. And me and my mom were there, and we were drinking. God, I sound like a drunk. But we were drinking, and I was pretty, you know, kind of drunk. And, I had a napkin, and we were kind of approaching the end of our meal, and I was just, like, holding the napkin kind of nonchalantly and, you know, motioning with it. And I guess it went into the candle, and the damn thing started, you know, lit on fire. And I was like, what? Because it was almost like slow motion. I looked at my mom, and I was like, what? And she was like, oh, my God. And then I looked kind of to my right, and the waiter is looking at me, and I'm like, it's okay. And then I, like, poured a bunch of water on it. But still, one of the funniest restaurant moments ever. The one other notorious sushi-related restaurant incident. I went to meet my buddy at this place in Venice. And it's kind of a goofy building. It doesn't look like a house, but there's like a couple of doors. There's like a back area and a front area. And so I was like, where the hell is the opening, the entrance? So I went to the back door and like kind of like, you know, tried to open it, had to give it a bit of a budge. And then as I opened the door, like again, in slow-mo almost, there was like this humongous glass pane that had been parked up against the door. And I pushed it and the glass just fell, crashed to the ground, sounded like a shotgun. And I just kind of slowly, nonchalantly shut the door, kind of looked around. No one seemed to notice. And then I just, you know, walked over to the restaurant, the correct entrance, and sat down. And I was just like, hey, I just, crash this door back there. But yeah, if there's like a way to like do things wrong, the wrong direction or something, I usually find a way to do that. And I know this podcast has been kind of an odds and ends one, totally random stuff, but dipping slightly back into the boxing episode. Well, number one, the best opening song for like a boxer to come out to is AC/DC's Thunderstruck, kind of before they start singing. but everything up to that point is like, just listen to that and imagine you're a boxer kind of coming down, you know, swinging some punches and stuff and get ready for the fight. Oh my God, it's incredible. These days, like boxers, a lot of times they'll have rappers like coming down with them. And A, the songs are usually terrible. B, you can't hear them. Or if they're doing it live, it really sounds like shit. And the songs are just, they're terrible. I mean, I don't know when that started, but it's a totally terrible trend. And there was this kind of funny, goofy boxer, Paulie Malignaggi. I think he was from New York. But he was okay, kind of feather-fisted, but a tough guy, you know, won quite a few fights. But there was like two incidents during his fights that were like, I'll never forget. On one of them, he had like these extensions, like almost like kind of dreadlock extensions, really long. And so during the fight, they kept falling off, like the thing that was holding them. And so they'd kind of go into his face. And then finally, like after about four rounds, they literally had to cut them off. Like the corner guy, they gave him some scissors and they cut off the guy, you know, the fake extensions. It was amazing. And then one other incident was like during one of his fights, his goddamn boxing shorts kept falling off. So like two or three times they'd be boxing and then his shorts would fall off. I don't know what they did. They tightened it up somehow, but it was just like, oh my God. And just to end on something so stupid, so funny, so worth watching, from 1991 on In Living Color, which was like a comedic show, like a skit show. A lot of great people were on it and it kind of got Jim Carrey's career going. But there's this thing called White White Baby. It's like a skit where Jim Carrey plays like a Vanilla Ice type guy. And he's just got the ridiculous, he's wearing the ridiculous outfit and just big shoes. And like his hair is all goofy as hell. And so it's like, you know, it's kind of the song is about him, how he like appropriates African-American culture and kind of is like, you know, ripping off rap, you know, to become popular, blah, blah, blah. And I guess his real name was Robert Van Winkle. But yeah, it's so funny. It's kind of lost in the ether out there. But try and watch that White White Baby. He's, you know, he's wearing this ridiculous getup, and like the very first line he says, he's like, "Yo VIP, let's kick it," and then he like kicks his foot and like the shoe comes off. Like goes way up in the air, and then he runs over to it and he starts putting his shoe on, and that's where like kind of the rest of the rap goes. All right, stop. While I do up my laces, this kind of thing happens every show. Yo, I gotta learn how to tie a bow. What's your real name? Robert Van Winkle. Why did you change it? Nothing rhymes with Winkle.